Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to today's History Hack. Today's History Hack promises to be very, very interesting. I have Kit with me. Kit, this is going to be good.
This is going to be very good. It's about one of the great cities of Europe. Our guest today is Victor Sebastian, who specializes in the history of Russia, communism and Lenin, and Eastern Europe. His books include 12 Days, the story of the 1956 Hungarian Revolution, Revolution 1989, the fall of the Soviet Empire, and 1946, the making of the modern world. Also, of course, Lenin, the man, the dictator, and the master of terror. But he's here today to talk about his new book, which is a history of the city of Budapest.
Well, thanks very much for asking me. I'm really looking forward to it.
This is, I guess the first question we have to ask is, why Budapest?
Well, it was the city of my birth, though I left it with my family as a refugee in 1956, which was, of course, the subject of my first book, when the Hungarians were trying to free themselves from the Soviet domination that had happened since the Second World War. And my family left in a hurry to escape as fast as and urgently as they could from Russian tanks. So that's, and then I went back repeatedly from about the mid-1970s onwards when I was a journalist covering Eastern Europe and Russia. And I've written about it constantly, and I just thought, I love Budapest, although I love its beauty and its charm, but I can also understand its darker, more cruel side. And I just thought it'd be a fascinating subject. And Budapest is, again, quite relevant and talked about for a country that's so small with only 9.5 million people. It sort of punches above its weight quite a bit, and it has quite a lot of influence in the world for good or and ill.
Well, let's start right at the beginning. So obviously Budapest is the capital of Hungary. For those who don't know, it's on the Danube. We've got the Buda side and the Pest side. But what is the earliest evidence of the site of modern-day Budapest? Who settles there, and why is it such a perfect place to build a settlement?
Well, there was a it's on the confluence of a huge river. It's in a vast European plain. It's basically everyone who went east. From everyone who went west from the east, as all those tribes did in the period known as the Great Migrations, they looked at that area and saw that it was good. The first settlements we know of were Celtic, from about 1000 BC. It has fantastic thermal springs, great water. And in fact, Budapest is still a spa city, and it was a spa city 3,000 years ago. The first big settlement, of course, was the Romans. The Romans occupied it. It was basically the northern perimeter that the northern and west perimeter that they possessed from all what the so-called barbarian tribes. So it was actually quite important to it. They built a string of fortresses across the Danube there to protect the northern part of its empire. And they were significant towns for a while, and had quite a lot of influence. One of the principal governors who built what must have been an extraordinary governor's palace there, although very little of it remains. A Soviet-era shipyard was built over it, as happened. That was Hadrian, who subsequently came, the emperor we all knew. Five future emperors had been governors of the province, that Hungarian province called Pannonia. And so it was quite a significant town. It grew into a town of 40,000, which around 200 AD, which is significant by Roman standards. And indeed, that many people wouldn't live on what the city of Budapest came for another 1,500 years after that, maybe 1,600 years after that. So it was a significant sign and significantly important. Another great character who was important in Roman Hungary was Marcus Aurelius, who many people might have heard of as an emperor, and wrote one of the greatest works of philosophy. A lot of it was written around a quincum, which was the Roman town because of the water.
I think because it's, as you said, like at this crossroads of East and West, everyone has to pass through it to get from one to the other.
Yeah.
That kind of puts a target on it throughout history, doesn't it? In terms of when people try and expand, there lies Budapest in the way. I want to make sure I'm conscious of, I don't want to tell everyone the whole contents of the book so they don't need to go and buy it. So let's skip forward.
We don't want to spoil it, do we?
No, yeah. let's leave a few hundred years behind us now, so that they do have to go and buy the book. But let's talk about when the Turks arrive. So we're talking about the Ottoman Empire expansion. What does life look like in Budapest under Turkish rule?
Budapest, to get your point about how it was on everyone's map, Budapest has been built and destroyed six times, just to get into context. The Turks came in the 16th century. Their ambition was the conquest of Europe, the Islamic conquest of Europe. And they got to the gates of Vienna, and that's as far as they got. So Hungary was basically the end of their western border in their attempted occupation of Europe. So again, it was an important border area. The Turks occupied for 150 years. It wasn't just a fly-by-night visit. And they kept repeatedly, three more times, they tried to get further west. They kept failing, they kept being pushed back, only as far as Budapest, or only as far as Hungary. There was no, and Buda, they built, they turned what was a kind of quite small town, although it was a royal town under the Hungarian kings, into a huge fortress town, very, very difficult to besiege, as indeed didn't happen for a century and a half. It's very, very small, and apart from the soldiers and the fort and the defenders, it's a very, very small town. And almost everyone who was German or Hungarian or Magyar, whatever, left. So 2,000, maybe 3,000 people, civilians at the most, apart from the janissaries and the defenders. Virtually very, very little is left of Turkish occupation. There are a couple of monuments. They turned the churches into mosques. The main things that were left, and they're of enduring, and they're rather wonderful, and they're still one of the great things about Budapest, why people should go and enjoy, is bathhouses. So they're fantastic spas, wonderful oriental, beautiful. And they built about 20 altogether, as we know. Six of them are still there, functioning pretty much as they must have done in the 16th and 17th centuries, and some of them really are magnificent and lots of fun. The other thing that as of enduring importance for Hungary, because Hungary is a place of coffee houses, and they were the first people who brought coffee into Eastern Europe, which was again an enduring and rather wonderful thing. So we do owe the Turkish occupation some rather brilliant thing. And when you think about it, that is better than some of the other occupying, the legacy of other occupying countries. Let's say the Marxists or the communists, what did they leave? Did they leave anything like a bathhouse? No. So we owe them quite a lot.
And my daily caffeine fix, I am most grateful for.
Me too. I never start the day without thanking those Turks.
But it's no spoiler to say it does fall back into Christian control. And if you've gone to Budapest, you can go to the cathedral and they've got St. Stephen's arm in there as a holy relic. You can go to Buda Castle and there are fantastic mosaics of the Christians defeating the Turks in the castle. So how does the city end up back in Christian control?
Well, the Habsburgs, and there were repeated attempts at, so-called crusade to try and turn back the Ottoman advance, and they tried repeatedly. They couldn't get it together enough until the Habsburgs, who were then, and the Holy Roman Empires. I don't want to go into the whole of Habsburg history, but they were basically
we'll be here all day, won't we?
We'd be here all week. It coincided too, and this is a kind of important point. It coincided too with the Reformation in Europe and the Counter-Reformation. The Habsburgs was the Catholic force, not entirely the Protestant force, which is an important point in all of this. So they tried repeatedly. They finally got it together in the middle, from the latter part of the 17th century. And a huge force went to besiege Budapest in the 1680s. And they finally, after a very, very long siege and an absolutely bitter, bitter struggle in which it's very hard to get accurate figures of death, and it doesn't really matter because the numbers involved. But again, the city was Buddha, as it was then was almost totally destroyed. There was hardly anything left of the palace, hardly anything left of the town. But Christianity was reimposed in Budapest, or in Buda anyway, and in most of Hungary, which then was a much, we'll get on to this later, much bigger and more significant place than it is now. And then they liberated, the army went on to try and, it took hundreds of years, the process of driving the Ottoman Empire back took a significant period throughout the 17th, 18th centuries. So, but this was the beginning of the fight back by the Catholic forces against the Ottoman Empire.
So let's move into the Baroque period now, because we start seeing this city growth. We've got reoccupation, and it's got a very distinctive architectural style in Budapest. So where does that come from? Where do we get that from?
Well, this comes from the Budapest was two towns. I want to get this across. Budapest didn't actually become one town until the 1870s. We think of Budapest. That's quite late, really. And it didn't have a bridge across until the mid 1840s, and it was really hard to cross. At that point, the Danube was much faster flowing than it is now. there are whole whole system of dams and dikes and things further upstream that cause that, and broader environmental factors. So it was two very, very separate towns. The Buddha, which is higher up on a hill with the palace, which was the old royal town, was almost entirely German. Everyone spoke German, almost nobody spoke Magyar, Hungarian. Pest was kind of a small village under, when the fight back from the late 17th century, a very small town was growing and growing, and that was the more commercial. Even then, that was the more commercial bit. So the real Baroque look of what became Budapest was built mainly in the 18th century, and it is a very typical Baroque, Baroque town, stucco buildings, classical. The church is unbelievably ornate. The main cathedral on the Buddha side, it's St. Marcharge Temple, St. Matthew's Church. It's very beautiful in this way, but way over the top. I mean, it's Baroque. I rather like it, but then, I rather like vulgarity sometimes. The thing about the other side, of Pest side, which was growing, but it took a long while, mainly its growth was the 19th century. And that distinctive look, which is the later Habsburg look of Budapest, was built later than that, than the Baroque part.
Which probably explains why it's so different. But speaking of vulgarity, we do have to touch on the Habsburgs, who are the masters of vulgar. Now they become sort of the rulers, essentially in control of the city, but this isn't a peaceful process, is it?
No, it wasn't. And just as a piece of background to try and set it into context, this wasn't just a fight back against the Turks. For the ultra Catholic Habsburgs, this was also the very important campaign in its front in the Counter-Reformation. The Hungarians, that area, which of course is a much bigger area than is present-day Hungary, it included large parts of Romania, all of Croatia, northern Serbia, Slovakia. About 70 to 75% of the people in that region were Protestants, either Lutherans or Calvinists. So to the Habsburgs, this was all a part to Catholicize Hungary. It was a large front in the Habsburg campaign during the Counter-Reformation. So just to get it into some context, and it was incredibly bloody. They killed and tortured thousands and thousands of people, and took away the property. And it was a process that began the richer people in order to the nobility made a deal with the Habsburgs that they would be allowed there to maintain their land and all their property if they became Catholics again. And 90% of them agreed. And it was this deal they'd made with the Austrians. A lot of the people had not made this deal. They may have performed lip service and became Catholics, but they'd never accepted Austrian domination. And there'd been a series of rebellions and open revolts, very famous ones that did well for a little while, but ultimately the Austrians kept control of Hungary. So it was an incredibly bloody process. And as Hungarian nationalism and the Hungarian aspirations grew, it became harder and harder for the Austrians to keep the Hungarians suppressed. And eventually there was a big rebellion as 1848. But it was a bloody it was a long and bloody process, and for a lot of that period, the Magyars never really accepted Austrian being a colony of Austria. They resented it, and there were increasing numbers of open and sullen rebellions.
We do end up with the dual monarchy. And as a First World War historian, I want to jump forward to that now and point out that people like to talk a lot about how Austria is responsible for the First World War because of the ultimatum issued to Serbia. But what people never talk about is Hungarian role in the outbreak of the First World War. And for me, it's really important. And I think the key to understanding it is understanding the decentralization of authority and how much lip service Vienna has to pay to Budapest at this point. So do you want to unpack that a bit for us?
I do. I will try. And again, you have to go back a little bit because the rebellion I mentioned, the revolution of 1848 and the War of Independence, that was the biggest rebellion against the Austrians. And they only suppressed it with the aid of Russia. It would not have happened without the Tsar, Nicholas I's intervention at the and again, it was a repression. But the Austrians were under extreme pressure. They had to fight wars in Italy, and then ultimately they had to fight wars against Germany. And they needed Hungary. A sullen and resentful Hungary wasn't going to help them. So in order to keep Hungarian aspirations quiet, they cobbled together this deal in 1867, a compromise, which gave Hungary kind of equal status in the empire. It was called, instead of the Habsburg monarchy, it was called the dual monarchy. It gave the Hungarians a lot of autonomy. The Austrians still were richer, so they put in 70% of the money, but they had only 50% control. And when it came to later, the Hungarians played the key role in the start of the First World War. The Austrians might not have gone to war without being pushed into it, significantly more so by the Hungarians, who their purpose was to there was increasing nationalist resentments amongst Slovaks, amongst Romanians, amongst Serbs, and the Hungarians thought the Hungarians are a nation whose their own nationalisms destroyed their nation significantly over long periods of history. And at this point, this is where that process is unpicked to be much more easily recognized. They thought that it could beat off any nationalist aspirations in the Balkans. That would strengthen their position. And they were much, much more fervently in favour of war than the Austrians were.
Yeah, so any concession
at that, all the documents proved this absolutely clearly. The Austrians might they were obviously in an alliance with the Germans, but they might have had the authority to wait and see a little bit longer, but for the fervent aspirations of the Hungarians. They were really wanting war.
Yeah, I think the key is, isn't it, that for every concession Austria might have made in 1914, the Magyars are there not wanting it because it dilutes their influence and dilutes their authority.
Absolutely. And they were at that, and they gave no rights. I mean, the first views everyone gets of Budapest is that wonderful parliament building, beautiful in its way. So pictures and all the picture postcards, and every Instagram has someone in front of the parliament building. It's the biggest parliament building in the world for almost the least democracy of anywhere in, almost no democracy. They had nearly half the people in what was Hungary were not Magyars, were not Hungarian, and only 3% roughly were represented in that parliament. They gave no compromises at all with the nationalism of them of every, to the Hungarians, nationalism, their nationalism was a fine and romantic thing, but they just didn't understand nationalism anywhere else. Key to them was keeping these territories, keeping those people suppressed.
Yeah, I mean, they're actually not only suppressing the nationalities, but there is a process called forced Magyarization, isn't there, where they're actively trying to make people into Magyars.
Yeah, they banned Magyar speaking was imposed. They in schools there were except in certain small number of areas there were some Transylvanian schools. There were a few in Croatia had a bit more autonomy than elsewhere, but the others not at all. It was forced Magyar. They could only see one nation, and it had to be the Magyar nation. That was clear. All their leading spokespeople were saying that sort of thing.
Well, we enter into then the 1920s, where there is obviously the Great Depression. They're aided essentially by Nazi Germany and fascist Italy. And that pushes them to the right, the very thing that they were trying to avoid, this nationalisation and then this nationalism. And so it becomes a fascist country, and eventually they join with the Axis in the Second World War. So what impact does that have on Budapest, both physically and culturally?
Well, physically, there was one very big one. Hungary were the biggest single losers in the First World War. They lost roughly 50% of the land and 30% of their population. All those lands I was talking about, the Transylvania, Slovakia, Croatia, northern Serbia, all that was lost in the Treaty of Trianon. Hungary was the biggest loser from the First World War. It lost about 50% of its territory, 30% of its population. It was a huge trauma, the Treaty of Trianon, from which it hasn't really properly recovered in some ways. Physically, it had a big effect on Budapest. First of all, because there were three revolutions in Budapest within a year. There was a kind of liberal democratic revolution that lasted a few months. There was a short-lived three-month Soviet revolution in the image of Lenin that lasted a very short time. And then there was essentially Horthy, you can call him a fascist or whatever, but anyway, it was a military dictatorship and an autocratic regime that lasted for another two and a half decades. Physically, it was a war-weary city, but the main thing was the number of refugees, hundreds of thousands of refugees from these countries, Slovakia, Croatia, wherever, the Magyars from those countries who were dispossessed. They'd lost everything once these new countries were formed. And they were a sullen mass. They were, a lot of them were living in all the railway stations, basically refugee centres. There was a huge camp just outside, on this outskirts of Budapest. And at one point, one of the biggest traumas of all, that Hungary had been occupied by Romanian troops and some Czech troops for a short period, and had caused mayhem. So, of course, for this trauma, they were looking for someone to blame. The obvious candidates were was the Soviet regime that launched this Red Terror for 3 months that killed scores of thousands of people, and then the White Terror descended on Budapest. Thousands of people have been socialists or even vaguely left-leaning or trade unionists had been arrested and killed. And the obvious candidate for blame were Jews. Over 25% of Budapest's population was Jewish. It was a very, very large and a very successful. They were probably amongst the most they'd assimilated significantly into Hungarian culture. A lot of businesses were owned, half the doctors, half the lawyers were Jews. It was a very significant size of the population. The first anti-Jewish popular legislation between the wars was started by Horthy in 1920. At that point, Hitler was still talking to small groups of disaffected Germans in Munich beer halls. So that, but it was Horthy and the Hungarians that did the first anti-Jewish legislation. And then when Hitler came in, Hitler promised the Hungarians that if he won the war, he would restore all these lost lands. And that became, regaining the lost lands became the most important demand and most important aspiration. All the politics in Hungary was only about regaining the territories that had been lost under Trianon.
I think it's one of those things that people probably don't appreciate the impact that decision by Horthy has on our world. Because one of the families that were forced to flee, one of the Jewish families, was Edward Teller's family.
Yeah.
And Teller became the architect of essentially modern nuclear weapons.
Yes.
He moved over to America. And so...
Mm. As indeed a huge number did.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so there was, when you talk about sort of the history of a sort of Cold War politics in America and a Cold War science, you have what's called the Martians, which were this group of predominantly Hungarian scientists who moved over. But let's focus on the city, because obviously we have Hungary entering the war, and in March 1944, the Axis powers actually occupy Hungary because the government seeks a peace settlement from the Allies. So what happens to Budapest, and how does it become part of the Axis front line, essentially?
That Horthy eventually could see the way things were going. This was and did try. Where he did, it was way too late by then, of course, but he did, and when the Germans came in, they were very enthusiastically welcomed. The Hungarian army did not, the Hungarian army did absolutely nothing. They just welcomed them. From then, of course, it wasn't that long after the German occupation, it was only a matter of a few months, that the Red Army was, sure to win and occupy most of Eastern Europe. It was only a question of time by then, and Budapest was in their way. It was the longest siege of any capital city in the Second World War. There were longer sieges, but of any capital. Berlin was probably bloodier. But the siege of Budapest lasted 3 months, All the bridges of Budapest were destroyed. That view. It was large parts of the center of the city were destroyed. It was hand to hand fighting in the town went on for weeks. There was no water supply. It was the description of life in Budapest in those 3 months were harrowing. And by the end, the Horthy had been arrested by the Germans and taken into custody. And the Germans approved a homegrown fascist government under an organization called the Arrow Cross, which were, you know, even crueler than the SS, if you can, you know, imagine it. And they were literally executing Jews on the banks of the Danube, which was an extraordinary process. Nobody in Budapest could say they didn't know what was happening to the Jews, because they could see it in their streets almost every day.
And that sort of more or less wraps up the Second World War, but we haven't even got on to the Iron Curtain. We haven't got on to the Cold War and the fact that it was a city sort of at the forefront of that, with spy things going on. We haven't got the current cultural influences today. So if you want to know more about that, you can read Victor's book. Victor, tell us where people can find it. It's out now. What's the name of the book?
It's called Budapest Between East and West. At all good bookshop.
Brilliant. Victor, thank you so much for coming on to talk to us.
It was a pleasure. Good.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org. where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them, and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/History Hack, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.